I'm Mark Laberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. My great pleasure today to welcome back to Conversing a friend of Conversing and a friend of mine and a friend of Fuller Seminary, Jamar Tisby. Jamar describes himself as a Christian, a historian, a writer, and a speaker. When he came on our podcast the first time, it was not long after the publication of his first book, which is called The Color of Compromise: The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. He serves, in addition to his writing, as an active leader in various movements. One of those is something that he's the president of called The Witness, a Black Christian collective. And he also is a co-host of a podcast called Pass the Mic Podcast. Jamar, it's really great to see you. Welcome back to Conversing.
It is great to see you too, even if it's virtually. I just love to interact with you. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, it's my joy. It's really, really been fun and amazing and impressive to me that in the providence of God, your book, The Color of Compromise, would come out as it did. It got a very positive and warm initial reception. And then it just gradually and in a very powerful way became a New York Times bestseller. It's an amazing thing for a first book to become a New York Times bestseller from a previously unpublished public author talking about, just maybe one of the most complicated and important parts of American history. That's a pretty big deal. Not everyone that's listening to this will have had a chance to yet read that book, which I highly recommend. But I think for everyone's benefit, just give us a kind of summary of the main argument of that book.
Sure. The New York Times bestseller status is interesting as a first-time author. There's nowhere to go but down in a way. pressure's off, however you want to do it. Yeah, exactly. So the idea of compromise and complicity is really central to the book. You know, it's been out for a year and a half, almost 2 years now. And a lot of the reaction is that those words, compromise and complicity, aren't in fact strong enough to describe the way Christians, mostly white Christians, have interacted with race historically. And I completely understand that because there are some really egregious and overt acts of racism perpetuated sometimes even in the name of Christianity. But in a sense, that's too easy. That lets us all off the hook too easily because we can look at those most extreme forms of racism, you know, people putting on white robes and hoods, tying the rope for the lyncher's noose, using racial epithets even. And we can see those folks and say, well, since I don't do any of this stuff, I'm not the problem. I'm not a racist. But the reality is, and I open the book with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, and when that occurred in September of 1963, there had been several weeks in a row of bombings before that, that Birmingham had already earned the nickname Bombingham. There was a neighborhood in Birmingham called Dynamite Hill because these acts of racial terrorism occurred so frequently. And the question is not so much, you know, what about the people who are actually planting the dynamite? Is what about the rest of the community that saw all of this and didn't muster the kind of response that would have prevented future acts from occurring? Right. And so what I say in the book is that the most egregious acts of racism occur within a context of compromise. So I want to get at that broad middle of believers who may not have been foaming at the mouth racist, but also through their silence, their apathy, their passivity, somehow contributed to the problem.
So in the landscape of the book, one of the things that I personally found so helpful was that it gathered up a collection of historical moments, insights, patterns, habits that were developing over the history of America. And you give shape to that narrative through a particular Christian lens. You're looking at how has the church interacted with race over this long arc of American history. And if you were to just summarize some of the inflection points in that narrative, how would you summarize it?
very early on from the first European contact with North Americans and with Native Americans and the indigenous inhabitants here, there was a stratification where even Christopher Columbus in his journals in the 1490s is basically evaluating Native Americans based on their physical appearance and on the degree to which he thought they could assimilate to European culture. As you move further along, of course, there's been this huge 1619 project that wasn't the first contact of Africans in North America, but it is a historical touch point about race-based chattel slavery. And so even in the early 17th century, you're getting this construction of this heinous institution that really defines so much of American history. You go further and you're talking about religion and race. So in 1667, there is the Virginia Assembly, which is a group of Anglican white men, pass a law about baptism that said baptism would not free an enslaved Native American, African, or person of mixed race descent. And so you get this bifurcation of the spiritual and the material. You move forward, 1776, Declaration of Independence, Constitution is ratified in the 1780s. And in those documents, although you have some sort of noble ideas stated, reality was it pertained specifically to white landowning men. And many other groups, including people of African descent, were sort of left out of that in terms of dignity, equality, freedom, etc. Civil War, of course, is, of all the books that have been written about the Civil War, I still think it is an underappreciated historical event in U.S. history, particularly as it pertains to race. And one example is the fact that we don't broadly celebrate Juneteenth, which is the oldest celebration of Black emancipation in the U.S. It's become more popular of late. But the fact that it's taken this long, I think, speaks to how so many people in the U.S. underestimate the racial history and the impact the past has on the present. And of course, the civil rights movement, which many people know about. But I think when King wrote that letter from a Birmingham jail and he talks about the white moderate, or as I would call it, the racial moderate, because I think it spans races and ethnicities, that really defines the Christian response, at least the evangelical Christian response in the civil rights movement. And then now, we have this sort of weaving together of a lot of different strands, particularly in the political realm, because we're talking about the rise of the religious right in the late 70s and early 80s. And I think that's still having a profound impact on politics today. But also more recently, you have the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is just the latest sort of wave of the longer Black freedom struggle. And I think right now we're sort of seeing history unfold before us in the way Christians interpret and respond to these events.
Well, that's a great summary. I just want to take you a little bit further into all that, because what you've lived over the last while since the book has been published is its own additional narrative, right? So you write this bold and courageous and very helpful book, and it lands in the marketplace. And as I say, it expands and explodes into a New York Times bestseller. Now, you must have been having experiences along the way where you are hearing things about the book that might have surprised you, that you would have thought, oh, no, that's not really what I was trying to say. I was really trying to say this, not that. What have been a few of those surprises?
I haven't shared this publicly because I recently just stumbled on it. I was doing a Google search for something unrelated, but a book review of The Color of Compromise came up, and it happened to be from, he wasn't a former professor of mine, but he taught at the seminary I attended. And then it was published in the seminary's journal as the official book review. And it was a very negative review, which I thought, just from a scholar or an academic standpoint, was actually a pretty superficial reading of it. Basically, he said, as a survey, this is just extremely selective, and it is setting out from the beginning to make a point about race in the church, which, by the way, every book does. It's called a thesis, right? So the question is not, are they trying to make a particular point? Of course they are. The question is, does the evidence back it up?
Right.
And this particular reviewer didn't think so. And many of the critiques of the book have been along those lines, that, oh, he's just cherry picking examples from history to present white Christians in the most negative light. I wish that were the case. We would be in a lot better situation if I had to go, you know, digging for those examples. But the problem wasn't finding enough. The problem was there were too many examples of Christian complicity with racism. And so the reality is the selectivity comes in not in demonstrating complicity, but in demonstrating resistance
to the complicity, right?
Yeah. So what a lot of folks today like to do is to imagine that the exceptions are the rule, when in reality, the exceptions prove the rule. Right. And so, sure, you know, there were some Christians and some white Christians who pushed back against the racial status quo, but that was few and far between. And it came at great cost. This is one thing people don't, I don't think, ponder enough, is I wrote in my second book, How to Fight Racism, about a church in the past 10 years that tried to address its complicity in racism during the civil rights movement. Well, the pastor who brought it up got run out of the church. And I'm sure we can come up with more examples of that. There's a book out, it's called Born of Conviction by Joseph T. Reif. And he writes about white Methodist ministers in Mississippi who put out a full page ad in some newspapers in support of Black civil rights. And within a couple of years, almost all of them had been run out of not only their pulpits, but out of the state as well. So all that to say, the critiques that this is sort of selective cherry picking history, no, it's not. The broad swath of U.S. Christianity has been in support of a racial status quo. And in those instances where folks have pushed back, they are the exceptions that prove the rule, and it came at great cost, which, by the way, that's still going to be true today.
Amen. Yeah. One of the things that I think struck me about the book when I first read it was that it felt to me like you were being exceedingly restrained in your language, that it felt like you were holding back from ballistics and just letting the evidence speak for itself. So what I find interesting about that review, as you have summarized it, is that it actually captures not your voice, but the voice of the actual actors in the real time and place in history in which they made statements, wrote papers, issued decrees of various kinds, and carried out actions that exactly display your thesis. And you are a PhD student at the University of Mississippi in history, and the seriousness of that work is very evident in your book. And yet, for legitimate and important reasons, you've made it accessible to the non-historical technician. And I think that's its benefit. It always is the case that such a book is then considered to be, quote, not adequate to the evidence, quote unquote.
That's right.
And you know that story. But in a way, the courage of the book is that you have gone out on a limb right at the very beginning of your professional career, a historical limb about something that is probably one of the most contentious aspects of American history. You've staked your life and your professional future on it. And that is also part of, I think, a faithful or responsible hearing of the book. This is not somebody who's either taking history lightly, nor somebody who is trying to skirt the details in order to make a polemical point at a critical time in American history. And I think read through that lens, I found it actually quite resonant with what I have understood to be history, but gathered together in a way that I'd never seen in one place at one time before. So to me, that was a terrific thing. Were there other surprises? I'm just curious. Often when you've written a book, it becomes a magnet that draws people to various themes or issues. What were the things, besides that kind of critique, what were the kinds of things that rose bigger than you even thought of them being, perhaps when you were writing the book?
You know, I was honestly surprised at the amount of positive response that I've gotten, which has been the overwhelming response,
yes,
actually,
absolutely.
In writing the book, because I've been through this before. I've been publicly speaking and writing about race for nearly a decade, and there's always pushback. There's always controversy. There's always conflict. So I was sort of bracing myself for that before the book came out. And then throughout 2019, and then again, the sort of resurgence in the summer of 2020 with the George Floyd protests and all of that, I get messages to this day, multiple times a week, about people, particularly white people, saying, I never knew and I'll never be the same.
Right.
Basically, after learning about this history, I think there is a healthy level of righteous anger, which is what I experienced learning about it. I've also been very encouraged by the response from Black people, too, because in a sense, it's like, you know, this is old news, right? We already knew. That's why we have Black churches.
Right.
We already knew there was an issue. But at the same time, I was in, I think it was Cincinnati, and was at a speaking event at the Mercantile Library. And one of the original Tuskegee Airmen was there.
Wow.
In his 90s.
Wow.
And he came early just so that he could meet with me privately and tell me how much the book impacted him, as well as some of his own stories that he had lived through.
Wow.
And to me, if I never write another word, I'm good because the people who lived through it and the people who know this history most intimately in so many ways, they're finding words and data and information they can use to bolster the impressionistic sense they had of this. But now they have sort of fact-based, data-based material to use as well.
Right. It's such an amazing story. And I think I just want to say, yes, exactly. When you summarize people saying, I just didn't really ever see this before. I didn't gather it all up. I think that was the first thing that just struck me, that you had made accessible what is apparently quite inaccessible to a lot of people, and especially a lot of white Christians. And it puts it on the table in a way that allows people to perhaps gather that in their own mind and heart in a very different way, and to really understand the full significance of this. In fact, I think one of the things about the book that I found so helpful was that it stitched together things that already laid out together in my mind, but I had never made some of the connections that you make in the book. And since reading the book, I have made a point of studying more about the history of racial curricula in the United States and the presence and absence of these themes in educational systems across the country, and the amount of control that there has been on even teaching about slavery as anything other than a kind of happy captivity in which people are well-fed and well-treated and do meaningful work and are able to live, of course, in the United States, not having to live any longer in the jungles of Africa, quote unquote. And that narrative and the dominant control over this historical story is, I'm sure, something that is right at the heart of why so much of this complicity actually exists. It isn't entirely about that, but I do think it is at least in part a genuine ignorance.
And this is such a current event now.
Right.
Because we have coming from the White House efforts to encourage, quote unquote, a patriotic education, which is a direct response and backlash against something like the 1619 Project, which invites readers to imagine 1619 as the nation's true founding rather than 1776. And I want to say that carefully, because it's not that any piece of work is beyond critique, right? That's not what anyone's arguing. And you can take issue with particular interpretations, but the project itself, to say that the enslavement of an entire people group based on their African descent is at least as foundational to the founding of this nation as the Declaration of Independence, I think that's self-evident. Right. I think that history bears that out. But now we're still having a battle, really, over textbooks, over how we are inculcating the next generation to think about our nation's history. And is it going to be this sort of triumphalist, yeah, we had problems, but, you know, yay, democracy, and, you know, this great experiment is largely successful? Or is it going to be a sobering sort of assessment that, yes, as many great opportunities as this nation presents, it also came at the expense of Native Americans, of people of African descent, of women for many eras? So it's just a more robust accounting, right?
Right.
And without that honesty, you know, what are we really buying into? We're buying into a myth.
Right. I'm Mark Laverton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So you've written this book, it explodes, it's having impact. COVID happens, and now suddenly the world is in a completely different space just because of that single fact. As it were, overnight, it becomes a completely different world now, mediated in the way that we're experiencing it right now. And as people at this conference that will be using this recording are going to be experiencing, it's an opportunity to realize that they're experiencing a conference in an entirely different way. But much more significantly related to race than in the context of the pandemic, in the context of all of the other upheaval that's going on, there's this burgeoning set of events, of which George Floyd's death is at least one major piece. Breonna Taylor, likewise. The list is long and tragic and painful. So first of all, do you look back on what you've written in light of this moment? And then I want to get into this moment itself. How did looking back at your book through the lens of the last 6 months affect how you saw what you'd written?
This year cements in my mind and heart the importance and the ongoing relevance of historical study. We really cannot understand 2020 without understanding 1960 or 1920 or 1820, if you will. we didn't land here ex nihilo. You know, we didn't just pop up in this moment, but there's a long pattern in history of even just, you could take protests and uprising, particularly around anti-Black police brutality. I was reading in some of the archives this morning of the Black Panther Party. And of course, their original name was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And self-defense against whom? It was against the police force, law enforcement that came into predominantly Black and low-income communities and acted as this sort of antagonistic presence there. And so this pattern of anti-Black police brutality is very long, goes really back into the 19th century. So that's helpful to unlocking this moment. The other thing that just strikes me is, you know, I never expected, it was a year and a half after the book came out, that there was this resurgence in interest. Obviously never expected or planned for that. And I'm still trying to put together in my head the role the pandemic has played in that. But in a sense, you use the word mediated. I think that's exactly right. So much of our lives are now mediated online. They were before, but it was like just amplified in a pandemic when you couldn't go anywhere. And I think people had the space or the opportunity to really dig into these issues of racial justice that we might not have before because sports were happening or we were taking vacations or whatever it might be. And now we're actually confined to a space and we actually have to focus on some things. And I also, last point, think it's very telling that people who were really conscientious about social distancing felt strongly enough about racial justice to get out and protest. And I don't think that's hypocrisy. I don't think that's a contradiction at all. They were, by and large, always wearing masks in these protests and whatnot. But it was so important that they would take to the streets even during a pandemic, which to me as a Black person is encouraging, but it also tells you how deep this problem is and how intractable it is and how hard we have to work to make progress.
And those protests continue.
Yes.
So one of the things I read about a year and a half or so ago was an article by a historian in a major newspaper in which he said the following, that as a historian, I'm aware that every generation says of itself, no other generation has been like this generation and this moment in history. And I've written long articles, he says, about how that's never true, how it's always the case that really it just is a repetition. But then he says, but now I want to say, this is not like any other season. And it is unlike anything I can think of comparing it to. Now, that could lead us down to simply a conversation about some of the partisan politics going on and so forth. But I'm more interested in the issues of race. In your analysis, what are the same things that are being raised? And then what are the new edges of this that are demanding, rightly and justly, for actual change and not just for more social conversation about the issues?
So I've said it tentatively up to now, but with much more conviction lately, that this is the civil rights movement of our day. And prior to this summer, 2020, I would have said there are echoes, there are resemblances, and would have posed the question, is this a movement or is this a moment? I really think this is a movement. That's for a couple of reasons. Number one, the scale and the scope of it, right? We're used to protests lasting a weekend or a week, maybe a couple. These have lasted months, months and months and months, with some very prominent clashes between protesters and the police. In addition, the number of people participating is in the millions. And there was a report in the New York Times that compared several studies that were estimating the scope of it. And basically they said people who have participated in a protest absolutely dwarfs the numbers during the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. So in terms of scale, it's much more massive. The other point that they made was there's much broader participation from white people. And so in the 1950s and 60s, you had the really courageous, rebellious white folks who might have gotten in there, but a very, very small number compared to Black people. Now you'll look at some protests and they're majority white in some cities, right? But expressing solidarity and expressing the need for change. The other things in my mind that really set this movement apart as a movement are the changes that have happened, even symbolically and culturally. A lot of people downplay those kind of symbolic cultural things. I still think they're important because the symbols indicate the stories we tell about ourselves, right?
Right.
And so if those symbols change, then hopefully the narrative that we're telling changes. So the big one for me was the state flag of Mississippi,
right,
where I go to school.
That was huge.
It's the last state in the Union to have the Confederate battle emblem on the flag, and it has stood on the flag for 126 years until the summer of 2020. Now, you can walk around till you're blue in the face saying nothing's changing. This time is no different than before. But I'll tell you, it took over a century for that flag to finally come down. And I'm so glad that it did. It's not all the change that we need, certainly not all the change that we need in Mississippi, but it is an important one. So, yeah, I think the historian is right. We're very hesitant to say that anything is unprecedented. And so I do think there are, you know, other moments in the past that have been really significant turning points.
Yes.
But I think the tendency now would be to underestimate how big a turning point this is rather than overestimate it.
So I want to imagine with you that you're elevated to kingly status, as it were, and
already in my own mind, that's where I am. I'm kidding.
I'm thinking of Martin primarily, but and if you were able to exercise the influence to bring about three significant changes that would actually move us forward as a nation, what would the three most important levers be, or the most important decisions, or the most important actions? What is needed? It feels like it runs the risk of diffusion and it runs the risk of dissipation unless it gets marshaled clearly around some particulars. And I guess I'm wondering, you may want to challenge that assumption, but in any case, what would be some of the particular things that you think most need attention?
So I primarily think along systemic and institutional lines. The first three that come to mind are some sort of financial reparations, which would include cash payments, but not be limited to it. We got to do something to close the racial wealth gap. So many of our issues are traced to a matter of material resources that is not disconnected from this nation's white supremacist and racist past and present.
Yes.
Secondly, robust voter protections that we can actually exercise the franchise, which is something that Black people have been fighting for since the Three-Fifths Compromise and before. So to really enshrine, codify, and protect those voting rights for not just Black people, but for any marginalized group. And then lastly, we have to do something about the so-called criminal justice system. The actual policing that happens on the street being sort of the tip of the spear, but also the entire process that once you get sort of roped into the quote unquote system, it is full of injustices that are outright appalling if you learn enough detail about them, something that no nation should conscience or tolerate, the way we treat people who are incarcerated and the way we treat people who are deemed, you know, disposable, criminal, whatever it might be. So those would be the top three that come to mind.
If you were to have the influence to do something about them, just take it a little more practically. So if we have those three categories, reparations first, what is the next step on reparations? There's been a bill unpresented onto the floor, as I understand it, of Congress for some time, or it's been marginalized in any case and never voted on regarding reparations. But whether it's that or something else, where would you turn as a very practical step related to reparations?
Sandy Darity and E. Kirsten Mullen have a new book out called From Here to Equality that really takes a deep dive into the practical aspects of financial reparations. They evaluate different models for figuring out who's a descendant of slaves or enslaved people, how much money is owed, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's scholarship, there's whole fields out there that really are examining this question. There's also a comparative aspect to it and see what nations like Germany have done in the wake of the Holocaust. And even in the United States, the reparations that were paid to actual slaveholders, if you want to look up the Compensated Emancipation Act of 1862 in Washington, D.C., you'll see that enslavers were paid for the enslaved people that they freed, but also in the case of Native Americans and Japanese internment. So there is actual precedent in the United States. So they've got a study committee, a bill proposed to form a study committee at the federal level. I think we should certainly move forward with that. But I'm also curious what states and municipalities could do apart from federal intervention. The biggest coffers are at the federal level, but there are things that more local governments can do. So there's that. I also think Duke Kwan, who's a Presbyterian minister in D.C., talks about the concept of ecclesiastical reparations and the idea that Christians don't need to wait on the federal or state or municipal government to act. But the way I think about it biblically is the passage that says, if you know your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go be reconciled, right? So if we know this history, and if we know there has been the financial and economic exploitation of Black labor as Christians, what then are we called to do? You know, our brothers and sisters have something against us financially and economically speaking. And yet we somehow think that's beyond the purview of the church or our ecclesiastical affiliations. So that's on reparations. Lots of stuff has been proposed for voting rights, particularly the reinstatement of voting rights for formerly incarcerated people. They've done their time, but in some places they can never get the right to vote back. And one wrinkle that we need to think about, oftentimes we delineate between violent and nonviolent crimes, but if you've done your time, you've done your time, whether that crime was violent or nonviolent. So I speak from a place of being a teaching assistant for 3 semesters in the Mississippi State Penitentiary and some other places in Mississippi. A Mississippi State Penitentiary was also known as Parchman Farm, and it was literally built as a plantation for convict leasing. So I'm in there with guys who are facing decades in prison for something they did as maybe an 18, 19, 20-year-old, and now they're in their 50s. And you're telling me, you know, once they get out, they can never vote because of what they did 30 years ago, and they're totally different people now. So I think that, you know, restoring voting rights to folks, certainly a reinstatement of the key provision that in the Voting Rights Act that was repealed in 2013, I believe, that led to a whole raft of states imposing, in the name, quote unquote, of voter protection, imposing measures that disproportionately affect Black, Brown, and poor people.
I thought it was a hopeful thing that Michael Bloomberg has come out saying that he will pay all of the fines unpaid by those people in Florida who would otherwise be excluded. And while that's an absolutely wonderful gesture and feels to me like it's obviously in part politically motivated, it doesn't matter. It's legitimate from my point of view, and yet it shouldn't be needed. So this is an example of the systemic problems, because really it's the system that's the problem about that. It's not the individuals that are involved. And yet they aren't in circumstances which can ever undo those circumstances unless they're actually truly set free from this ongoing burden, which is an example of the ongoing legacy that's managed by systemic racism in many, many different ways.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And then on the last part on mass incarceration, criminal justice, this hashtag has gone around in 2020, defund the police. And a lot of people have a visceral reaction to that. And I think that's a couple of things. One, we've sort of been trained to view police officers as the good guys, quote unquote, which is understandable. And anybody who puts their life on the line in their job is showing some extreme courage there. But at the same time, we have to understand the origins of the police force. There's a very short but informative article I would recommend by an author named Carrie Lee Merritt, and it's called One Continuous Graveyard, where she traces the origins of the police force to slave patrols in the 19th century and the emancipation of enslaved people. That's really where you get sort of municipal standing police forces.
Yes.
And then on up to the present day. And there's lots of works out there that are similar.
Yes.
But defunding the police is really about reallocating funds, right? And so instead of putting these massive financial resources to really the sort of last resort kind of intervention when something has gotten way out of hand, you divert those resources to preventative measures, particularly things like mental health care, poverty alleviation, right? When I was a school teacher, I taught 6th grade in the Mississippi Delta, and you quickly learn that, you know, this is a high poverty area. 99% of our students were Black. And you quickly learn that whatever issue came up in class was the result of 5 or 6 different issues outside of class.
I'm sure.
So if the kid came in and they didn't have their homework, well, yeah, it could be lazy. Most of the time it wasn't. Maybe it was because their parents had a fight and they had to stay at someone else's house. Maybe it's because they're functionally homeless and they're staying at 3 or 4 different houses in the course of a week. Maybe their parent had to choose between fixing their car and paying the light bill, and they didn't have power at home at night to be able to do their homework, right? So defunding the police is the difference between, you know, a teacher coming in with the punitive consequence for whatever the behavior is in class and investing the resources in figuring out what's happening outside of class and what to do about it.
Right.
So I think that's just, again, it's common sense that if we step back from the sort of political, emotional, visceral reactions that we have and we look at it in different realms or on a smaller scale, it makes total sense. But it's become such a polarizing issue that it's controversial. And in the meantime, you still have a lot of violence being enacted upon Black bodies in particular.
Yes, yes. Well, certainly since Michael Brown's death and forward, there's been this emerging movement called Black Lives Matter, and it has had an enormous sway, and many people have suggested it is the leading edge of all racial transformation that needs to be attacked and changed. I'm just curious if you want to share any words about how you think about Black Lives Matter. How do you think about Black Lives Matter in relationship to your faith? How do you think about Black Lives Matter in terms of its effectiveness? And then, for many white people, the most controversial thing is this claim of its Marxist character. So I'm just, have at it. It's a dartboard. Yeah. Well, it is also a force, I think, of a great deal of good. It is clearly caught in a verbal vortex. And I'm just wanting you to sort that out for us.
Whew, there's so much to unpack here. Let me start with this. Black freedom movements in any era have never been popular, particularly among white Christians. So the abolitionist movement was countered with pro-slavery theology, right? In the Jim Crow era, there's this toxic mixture of Christian nationalism, which we see with the birth of the Ku Klux Klan, the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915, where they go to the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia, burn a cross, build an altar, put a Bible and an American flag on there, and sort of meld white supremacy and whiteness, Christianity, particularly Protestant Christianity, they didn't like the Catholics, and then this sort of toxic form of patriotism, right, which we can see even on to the present day. And then the civil rights movement. I was reading one history book that said in 1966, nationally, Martin Luther King had a 28% approval rating. 28%. So never popular, even in its quote unquote most religious form, right?
Right. Supposed heyday. Right.
Right. Right. So like Christians today would basically be like, well, why can't you be more like the civil rights movement where, they're singing spirituals and meeting in churches and whatnot? They didn't like them back then. And then I think it's probably even more comparable, the Black Lives Matter movement compared to the Black Power movement, because there's this sort of in your face in a self-assertive way about being Black, about being proud of one's race and cultural background, about self-determination, all of these things, right? And the response to Black Power was even more negative than the response to the civil rights movement. A couple more things, a couple more layers to add on to that. Not only was it never popular, I have moved away from making a huge distinction between BLM as a concept and BLM, the organization. Not because there isn't a distinction, but because so often I find Christians using that as an excuse not to get involved in all.
Yes.
At right. all. And one of the founders is self-avowedly trained in communist Marxist kind of ideology and tactics. That'll be my third point that I get to in a minute. There's a history there that has a lot to do with race. But they'll look at the organization, they'll look at the sort of communist Marxist stuff, and then they'll look at a page on there, which I believe actually has recently been taken down or changed, but they'll look at a page on there that says they are, I forget the exact word, I think it starts with a D, but working to maybe deconstruct the Western prescribed nuclear family, which white Christians have taken to mean, oh, they're against the family unit, which is the basic unit of society in the Bible, right? So it's anti-Christian. You can't ever get along with it. That's not what they're saying. They're saying it takes a village. And the reality is many cultures, most cultures, even in the U.S. up until about the 1950s and the growth of the modern middle class, were very intergenerational, very community-based ways of raising a family, right? So it's sort of a very superficial, if not intentional, misreading of what they're actually saying. All of that to say is when people start to label the organization as not just not Christian, but anti-Christian, and then they use these labels like communism and Marxism, not simply as descriptors of different sort of political ideologies, but as epithets, which is certainly what happened in the 1950s and onwards and during the Cold War era, then there's no alternative presented. Most of the time, right? So, okay, I can't get down with this organization, but here's how I am helping. No, no, no. It's just a critique. Here's the other thing. Biblically, I was reading in Esther 4, in that great passage, right? For such a time as this, right? Where Mordecai is speaking to Esther. But he also says in that same set of verses, if you don't do it, God is going to raise up another. And could it be that in our modern U.S. context, when it comes to issues of racial justice, the church could have led on it. But in the absence of a strong voice promoting racial justice from the church, the Lord raised up another. Black Lives Matter is not an explicitly Christian organization, but maybe that is more an indictment on the way Christians have approached it than
yes.
it is on the organization. And then the very last part I'll say about the connection between communism and Marxism, understand that historically, especially in the 20th century, it was often communists and Marxists who had the greatest racial solidarity with Black people. This is because they were using a class-based analysis of politics and society, which lumped all the proletariat together, whether you were Black or white, Northern, Southern, urban, or rural, which meant that they were finding themselves alongside Black people in many cases where white people, particularly white Christians, were not advocating for Black people. And of course, what most Black people found was that the communist interpretation fell short because it separated race and class starkly. And in the U.S. context, you can't do that because they're almost mutually constitutive in our society. But in cases like the Scottsboro Boys, who were a group of young Black men who were unjustly accused of raping or attacking a white woman, almost nobody came to the aid of these folks other than Black people and people in the Communist Party. You go forward into the 1930s and 40s, and the labor organizing movement was strongly upheld by communists and Marxists, and Black people were the ones on the lowest rung of the ladder in the industrial workforce. And so they found themselves often alongside communists and Marxists because they were advocating for sort of class uplift that transcended racial divides at the time. So there's a long history of Black radicalism. There's a long history of solidarity that they found among these folks with this particular political ideology that white Christians and supposedly proponents of democracy never demonstrated near the level of solidarity that they had. So I'm not saying that one should take this position or not. I'm just saying there's a history there.
Right. Jamar, I could talk to you about these things for hours. I want to go out by simply saying that you've written a second book, and it's called How to Fight Racism. And the subtitle is Courageous Christianity and the Journey Toward Racial Justice. I just hope it's even half the first book and that it gives us the kind of handles wherever we are socially located, whatever our race may be, to join in a fight against racism. And I just am really, really grateful for the call and work vocation that God has given you. I'm thankful for how you're exercising it and look forward to our next conversation before too long.
I appreciate the work you're doing for the kingdom and, as always, asking great questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.